What we're talking about right now, the law of the teaching process. That's where we are. Okay? Now, I think we got down to about number 22, was it last week? Does anybody remember? Is that where it was? Okay. And we were, okay, 22A. There's not a 22B. I know that that's not the right way to outline. Okay? I know that if you have an A, you got to have a B. Okay? But I don't have a B. Sorry. Make your own B. All right? But at any rate, number 22 said, the object or the event that excites no question will provoke no thought. Questioning is not therefore merely one of the devices of teaching. It is really the whole of teaching. All right, now what are we talking about? In this class for several weeks, we have been studying techniques and methods and procedures that we need to be learning in order to be able to influence two important groups that God is going to hold us responsible to influence. Tell me who they are. The lost and our children. Those are two groups that we have to be responsible to influence. Don't have any options about it. Now, again, so often when we try to go out and influence the lost, we do so with our own innate ability, which is often no ability at all. And because we are not successful at using our poorly prepared abilities, we're not effective. We don't win anybody. And we've been talking an awful lot lately about what it takes to be qualified to influence somebody for Jesus Christ. Remember what we said last Wednesday night? That one of the main things that's going to be required if we're going to influence somebody for Christ is a genuine burden for them in the same way that Christ had a burden for them. That's what taking up the cross is all about. So soul winning is not a technique that you learn like salesmanship. Soul winning is something that you do because you understand why you're here. It's the same responsibility that we have for our children. If we are to be influencing our children, we must develop the skills that are necessary to do so. Now, I'm convinced that most Christian people today are trying to influence their children out of necessity rather than out of genuine commitment. In other words, the tyranny of the urgent is the method that they use. Now, what do I mean by the phrase, the tyranny of the urgent? Anybody ever read that little book called The Tyranny of the Urgent? What does it teach? Okay? Oh, whatever I got to do right now, that's what I have to do. Right, okay, comment? We often end up doing what's urgent instead of what's important. One of the big problems that a lot of people fall into today is this pattern right here. They end up doing what they have to do instead of what they ought to do. And as a result, sometimes even without realizing it, they create circumstances where the pressure that they're under compels them to do what they want to do. So they always have a ready-made excuse. Yesterday, I had a fellow come over to see me, and it was so sad. He came to my door, and he said, look, I got to have some help. And of course, you know, this happens a lot when you're in the ministry. And I said, well, how can I help you? He said, I've got to get my medicine for diabetes. He said, and I'm all out of money. He said, and I haven't had my medicine for several days, and I'm getting sick, and I've just got to have some money for medicine. And I told him, and I said, well, sir, I said, I want to help you, but I've got a policy. I cannot give you any money. Well, why not? And I said, well, because I've given people money in the past. And I cannot think of too many situations where I have given people money where they didn't take it and use it for tobacco or alcohol. I said, but I'll tell you what I will do. I'll give you some groceries. Well, he complained about that for a while. So I took him over to the office and went to the Five Lowe's cupboards there, and I put him together a bag of groceries. And of course, he was asking me, don't you have any meat? I said, no, we can't keep meat over here. And, well, don't you have any canned meat or anything? No, I don't have any canned meat. I'm sorry, I don't have any right now. I'll give you what I've got. And when you hear those kinds of things, you think, this guy really want help. And so, I've got to get this medicine. I've got to get this medicine. So I got right up in his face. Come here, Jeff, you be my friend, okay? You be the guy, okay? I got right up in his face, just about this close. And I said, now look, I want to help you. And I'm going to help you. Well, I really appreciate that. I really appreciate that. I said, here's what I'm going to do. I'm not going to give you any money. That's the best thing I can do for you. You understand that? Well, I don't say, no. Shake your head up. Okay. No. He said, no, I don't understand that. I said, I'm going to tell you why. See, you had some money somewhere within the last 24 hours. No, I haven't had any. No, yes, you did. Yes, you did. I'm going to tell you why. Now, look, I wasn't born yesterday, okay? Whatever you've been drinking, you paid money for, or you got somehow. You understand that? Well, I haven't been drinking. And he recently, in his pocket, he got a bottle of cough syrup. He says, I've had a real sore throat, and I've had to drink his cough syrup. I said, let me tell you something. I know the difference between cough syrup and liquor, and you've been drinking liquor. Okay. Now, at this point, he got mad at me, and he tried to make me feel guilty. Thank you very much. And he turned around, and he took the, oh, you can just keep these groceries and just keep them. I said, now, look, you take those groceries, and you use those for your family. I said, well, let me tell you something. The problem is not that I don't believe you. The problem is you don't even know whether to believe yourself anymore. Now, let me tell you something. If you want to turn your life around, you got to start being honest with yourself. You can lie to me. That's no problem, because it's my choice whether or not I believe you. But if you start lying to yourself and believing your own lies, buddy, you're never going to get straightened out. Right? And you know what his problem is? He's believing his own lies. You know, it's an awful thing for somebody to lie to somebody else, and then they become indignant when you don't believe them. Isn't that right? There he is lying through his teeth to me. I know it. He knows it. God knows it. Everybody knows it. And he is indignant because I won't believe him. You understand what I'm saying? Now, should I have believed him? No, I shouldn't have. Okay? Now, I did that to a fellow one time who came to see me, and he says, you know, I need several things. I said, what do you need? He said, I need some eggs. I said, well, I got a few eggs in the house. I'll get you some eggs. So I went and I cut the carton in half, you know, and I gave him some eggs. And he said, I need some coffee. So I scooped him out some coffee and put it in a pint jar. He says, then I need a couple dollars. He said, now, preacher, he said, I'm not going to lie to you. And I said, what are you going to do with that money? He says, I'm going to buy some cigarettes with it. I said, all right, I'm going to help you. He said, I appreciate that. And I said, here's the coffee, here's the eggs, no money. He said, I thought you were going to help me. I said, I just did. He said, you're a good man, preacher. He said like that. He understood exactly what I was doing. You understand what I'm saying? Now, the point I'm making is, if you really want to help somebody, you got to be honest with them, okay? And I am convinced that sometimes Christian people, now I want to be honest with you, I don't want you to be honest with yourself. The tyranny of the urgent takes over in our lives. And we force ourselves into circumstances where we feel like we have to do what we want to do. You understand what I'm saying? Now, you don't have to do anything except what you have to do. Does that make sense? Sometimes people get themselves in a situation where the pressure that they have put on themselves forces them to do the things they wanted to do. And then that pressure becomes their excuse. You follow what I'm saying? Here was a fellow yesterday that felt like, look, I have got to have some money. Now, why did he have to have the money, as far as he was concerned? Yeah, what was his medicine? Okay, yeah. Say, look, he was sobering up and he was hurting. Hey, I understand that. I understand that. He was sobering up and he was hurting bad, and he needed some medication. Except the kind of medication he wanted is not the kind of medication I buy for people. Understand that? Now, he had to have that. And in his mind, he absolutely had to have something to drink. But he knew that if he told somebody that he had to have something to drink, he wasn't going to get it. So he had justified lying in his own mind to be able to get what he wanted. That's the way our society lives today. Since they have to have what they think they need, they try to find a way to justify it, even with lying. And they feel that it's okay to lie because they have to. You understand that? Now, Christian people do the same thing. Christian people put themselves in a position where they are compelled by the necessity of the moment to do what they want to do. When the truth of the matter is, you and I have a choice. We have to do what's right, not just what we choose to do. And if we create circumstances where we are pressured by those circumstances which we have created to do what we want to do, we deceive ourselves. Does that make sense? You follow me on that? Okay. With those thoughts in mind, let me urge you, encourage you, to do what you ought to do rather than continuing to live under the pressure that forces you to do what you really wanted to do all along. You follow me? Take a good close look at your life and examine to see whether you are under a lot of pressure that is of your own creation. I think many people are today. Oh, but I have to do this and I have to do that. And when you stop and think about it, you really don't have to do some of the things that you think you do. You do them by choice because that creates a circumstance where you can justify what you've chosen to do. Does that make sense? All right. Now, with those thoughts in mind, let's come back to these methods about teaching for a few minutes. The object or the event? Now, what are we talking about? The law of what? The teaching process. What does the law of the teaching process state? All right. Excite the self-interest of the student, and as a general rule, don't tell him anything he can learn for himself. Now, those of you who are coming into this and the first lesson that you've heard out of a series of many, many lessons, you're going to think, wait a minute, that doesn't sound right. You know, aren't you supposed to lead? Aren't you supposed to encourage? We've been through all that. Okay? We've been through all of that business of encouraging a person to think with you and to understand what you're saying. Now we are at the point where we're trying to get the teacher to pull away a little bit and not spend all of his time telling, but rather leading. Okay? So the law of the teaching process is helping us to direct the self-interest of the student. Now let's apply that to soul winning for just a few minutes. If you're going to lead a soul to Jesus Christ, and you're going to remember this principle right here, what are you going to do? Let's talk. How are you going to apply this principle in soul winning? Yes, sir. Why do we want to do that? Okay. All right. Suppose, for example, that you're giving somebody the plan of salvation, and you've explained to him who God is and who Jesus Christ is and what Jesus Christ has done for him, and then you find that you can't get this person to receive Christ. Why? Why won't he receive Christ? If he knows who God is, and he knows who Jesus Christ is, and he knows what Jesus Christ has done for man, what's another reason that this man wouldn't be willing to accept Christ as his Savior? Yes, sir. Oh, okay. Maybe he doesn't know he has his own personal need. So you might ask some questions along that line. And so you ask some questions to see if he knows who God is. Well, yeah, he acknowledges God. He acknowledges Christ. Why won't he receive Christ? And then it dawns on you, I bet he doesn't know that he needs to be saved. Now, you might have asked him a couple of questions, and he might say, oh, yeah, I know I need to be saved. Everybody needs to be saved. But he might just be giving lip service to that answer, and he might not really understand the concept. So the way that you find out is by questioning and thinking through and getting him to express that. Yes. Okay. He may think that there's something that he can do to earn salvation. He may think he needs it. But now if he does that, then he doesn't fully understand the nature of sin. You got to go back and teach a little bit more on that. Okay, so by questioning and leading this person to his own understanding, you can then help him to realize it. Look, one of the problems that we have in any kind of teaching that we do is merely getting a person to acknowledge what we're saying rather than getting them. One of the most important techniques that you can use with your children or with a soul that you're leading to Christ is to get them to put it, to give it back to you in their own words. Especially is this true when you're working with children. A little child comes forward. You put your arm around his shoulder and you say, do you want to get saved? What do you think he's going to say? 100% of the time. You think he's going to say, well, no, actually, I came forward to discuss a problem I'm having with my parents. And you think he's going to do that? No. You want to get saved? Uh-huh. Do you believe in Jesus? Uh-huh. Well, let's just pray right now. Okay. You know, and he'll just do everything you tell him to do. That's why it's very important that you don't tell the child what to say. Little child comes forward. Why did you come forward today? I want to be saved. What does that mean? I want to ask Jesus into my heart. What does that mean? You see what I'm saying? Find out if he understands. You see, you're making it hard for him. Call it what you want to. Make sure he understands. Make sure he understands. Don't just get the person. Look, you can say, what, do you want to get saved? Uh-huh. Okay, well, let's pray. Ask Jesus into your heart. Jesus, come into my heart and save me. Now, are you saved? I don't know. Okay, well, now here's what the verse says. Blah, blah, blah. Are you saved? Yes. Okay, I'm saved. And, you know, add it to your statistics. Now, that's not the point. The point is to communicate and help the child to understand. And if you lead that person to a decision under those circumstances, it's going to be very hard to get him to make a real decision later. Is that right? Have you ever met somebody that you believe that they were lost, but they talked about an experience that they'd had one time, and it was very difficult to communicate with them? Here they were still living like the old man, and yet they referred to an experience that they'd had at some point. They said, well, this is what happened to me. Okay. All right. So, the object or event that excites no question will provoke no thought. Therefore, in the teaching process, when you're trying to communicate an idea to somebody, try to provoke a question. Try to get them to ask something. It's best to leave the end of the class or the end of the session or the time together with a question on somebody's mind. The best teachers don't answer every question and tie up every loose end and say, okay, fine, you know, so that you don't feel like you ever have to go back. The classes that you really enjoy are those ones that leave some things unresolved so that you want to go back next time. Now, in our systematic thinking, sometimes that's frustrating to us. Sometimes when I sit down to study, well, I want to trace every option. And I want to consider every point, and I want to make everything and put it in a nice, neat little package. But it doesn't usually work that way. What I usually have to do when I'm studying is keep a notepad over here to write down things I don't have time to study now that I want to study later. Because so many things come up that I just can't answer right now, I have to get back to it later. You follow that? So you jot these things down, and then you consider them later. Now, that same thing is true when you're trying to teach somebody else. Leave some questions for later. It does not follow that every question should be in the interrogative form. Okay. Leading the conversation to get it to the place where you want to go. Yes. Okay. Yes, sir. Some statements raise questions in the listener's mind. Okay. That's exactly what we're talking about. Now, let me illustrate to you this idea that Bob was talking about leading the conversation. You know, there's an old trick that people used to play some time back. Dave, you help me here. All right, now, I'm going to give you a number. Close your eyes tightly, real quick, okay? Okay? Now, Dave, all right, you can open your eyes again. I want you to pick a number. Pick two numbers between 1 and 10.
7 and 3.
7 and 3. All right, let's see. Now, we want a number then that's between 7 and 3. All right, pick two more numbers between 7 and 3. 6 and 4. All right, pick one of those.
Six.
All right, 6. What was the number that we were looking for, folks?
6.
And he picked the number, didn't he? How about that? You see how that worked? Now, you know, card sharks use that all the time, you know, and take a lot of people's money away from them. Now, what did I do? Suppose that he'd said 6 and 4 and he'd pick 4. What would I have said? Oh, well, that leaves 6. Okay, great. In other words, you just go right on. Now, that's exactly the way you do that. In other words, you keep coming back to the thing that you want. Keep coming back to the thing. Now, that can be deceptive if you're not careful. I mean, if you're using it to be deceptive. But it's also a way of keeping on track. That's what the teachers mean when they say, you know, don't get off track. And of course, that degenerates very quickly. And they say, you know, don't follow any rabbit trails. Now, if a fellow asks a question, you'll get back to the main business. Now, you got to be careful about that. Do answer his questions, but always answer his questions in such a way that it gets him back to the point. You follow? Do the same thing with the children. Now, and you can lead and cause them to question and look for something. Now, when he was looking for that number, I never did ask him a question, did I? I gave him an order. I gave him a command. I suggested that he do something. But he was still questioning his mind. He was looking for something, wasn't he? Now, that's a simple little illustration to help you remember a technique. Like these men have been saying here, to look for an answer. Provoke something. Make a statement. Lead them to a question. Point out something. Some people say, quote. Now, what's the implication there? What do you say? What do you think? What do you think about that? Or you might ask simple questions, or sometimes questions can be implied. Carol, you had a comment a minute ago. It's good. It's good. That's a good point. Good point. You laugh because you know that's true. That's right. We what is humorous to us is what we identify with. Boy, that is true. All right. So when we're working with children or when we're working with people that we would win to Christ, we must remember that we must get them asking questions about the subject material. Now, the way we do this is not just by asking them questions ourselves, but by provoking questions in their mind. Now remember, this is one in a long series of techniques that we're learning. And you need to go back and review these. All right, the next one says, the explanation that settles everything and ends all questions usually ends all thinking also. Well, that's a good principle right there. Now let me ask you a question. Okay? Have you ever been responding to your children impatiently and with an air of finality that frustrated them? See, there were two different things going on. There are times when the children come and they just want to relate to us. They want to talk to us. They want to hear what we have to say. They may not necessarily be looking for information. They're looking for acceptance and fellowship. Why do we tend to answer our questions with an air of finality rather than asking a question that will provoke another question? Why would we do something like that, do you suppose? Yes. All right, okay. Now, Roger has introduced a very interesting point about fundamentalists always answering other people with an air of finality. Now, my thought was about answering our children with an air of finality, but I believe the reason that we do that is the same. All right, yes. Julie? Want to be an authority. Why would we want to just be an authority? John? Might not know the reason why we're giving the answer. Okay. Jerry? Don't want to think? Why would we not want to think? Yes, sir.
Because we might discover that what we believe about something isn't really true.
Get up from there. Okay, just a minute. We might discover that what we really think about something isn't the truth? Are you saying to me that we answer questions with an air of finality when people ask us questions because we don't want anybody rocking the boat? We don't want anybody rattling our cage, as it were? In other words, we're not real sure about this thing ourselves. And we don't want anybody challenging us or shaking the foundation. Is that what you're saying? You know anybody like that? Have you ever noticed how people that aren't real sure of things always tend to be very adamant in their defense of it? Ever notice that? Have you ever noticed that the more uncertainty and insecurity you have about the positions that you hold, the more vehemently you tend to defend them? Have you ever noticed that to be true? Why is that? I mean, if that's true, why is that true? Somebody want to make a comment? Don? Yeah, you know, and I'll tell you something. In the best way in the world to find out the inconsistencies in the positions that you hold and the reasons why you hold them. Tremendous technique for discovering those inconsistencies is have some kids. That's right. And let them become teenagers, and they will point out many of those inconsistencies to you. Yes, sir.
A lot of time to wait.
Ben has made a statement here that needs to be discussed. He has said your theology changes when your kids get to be teenagers. Is that true? I've heard somebody say, well, I just think you ought to have a big family. You know, I mean, here they are, boy, they're getting ready to have their third one. And, you know, they're saying, I think you ought to just have as many kids as you possibly can. They don't say that after five or six too much anymore. Huh? It's not that their theology is changing. I know what Ben is saying. It's that people kind of realize that it's easier to say something than it is always to back something up. And you need to be a little bit careful. It's like the one preacher said, you know, let him that is raising teenagers boast not as him who has them raised. Okay? That's a true principle. How about this one? You're sitting there watching a videotape that you've rented with the family, and all of a sudden one of your kids says to you, how come we don't go to Hollywood movies? Okay, now what do you say? Shut up now, we're trying to enjoy this film together. Is that what you say? Huh? Be quiet, I want to see this. What do you say? What's up, the devil? Is that what you say? That's what you said before. Isn't that right? Now what are you going to say? Sitting here watching the football game. Too much violence on TV. Boy, I don't go for all this stuff. All this shooting and killing. Look at, did you see him hit that guy? All right. You know, I mean, the kid's sitting there thinking, you know, yes. Mm-hmm. Now, what are you going to say when you get asked that by one of your kids? What are you going to say? Yes, sir. Okay. Can of worms, too. Okay. Give us an illustration. Think of one. In other words, if we have a set of standards for them when they're little, and then the standards, are you saying they loosen up a little bit?
The paddle.
Yeah, the rod of correction. Yeah, okay. Well, I don't know. What do you think? Yeah, they might start beating you back, he said. Okay. Yes, sir. Hey, Carson, how you doing? Good point. I think one of the main things we have to remember is stated right there, that in establishing standards as Christian people, we have to realize that all standards are artificial. Every rule is a rule that you make because you have to have a rule. And every rule that you make does not carry with it the same authority of inspired Scripture. Okay, as that which is the only kind, of course. But it doesn't carry the full authority of inspiration, is what I'm saying. Okay? And how about this one? Suppose, for example, that you make a rule, and then you grow, and you realize, you know, that rule is really unjustified. Now what are you going to do? Are you going to admit it, or are you going to say, consistency is just as important as anything else? Therefore, let's be consistent. Well, I'm not suggesting to you that you redraw your rules because you can't enforce them any longer. I'm saying that sometimes we do grow and we learn, and I think we tend to make a lot of rules when we're younger. When we get older, we feel like, I'm not sure that was smart. But on the other hand, I think God knows what He's doing when He gives children to young people. You know? I've said to you before, and I believe this with all my heart, that God doesn't give us kids because we got the sense to raise them. He gives us kids so we can learn from them how to help them raise theirs. Now, an awful lot of people, you know, when they're 50 or 60, they could be a lot better parents than they could when they were 20 or 30. But why did God set it up so that 20 and 30-year-olds have the kids? It's not just for the benefit of the kids. It's also for the benefit of the 20 and 30-year-olds. And if those 20 and 30-year-olds are smart, they won't cut themselves off from mom and dad who are 50 and 60. Follow that? Because the greatest source of help they can get in raising those kids is their own parents. Yes, sir? That's right. That's right. Brother Kramer's got the point right there. A lot of times we establish standards when we're young because we want to prove something to our peers. We want to prove something to our kids. I mean, this is the way it is here at our church. I mean, you know, we have this haircut standard here because we're more fundamental than they are, you see. I mean, we wear these clothes, we don't wear those because, well, I just want everybody to know that, you know, I'm strong, you see, and this kind of thing. Because a lot of times when we're trying to prove our strength to others, we try to prove our strength in ways that doesn't really prove strength at all. And then a little bit later on, we start thinking, you know, man, I wonder if I'm going to be able to live by that rule all my life, you know. And then, you know, the people that fall the fastest, is that good grammar? That fall faster are the ones who are the most rigid. The people who set themselves up for failure are the ones who are the most rigid. You know, and that's why I say people are inflexible and unwilling to bend when they've learned things because they don't want to appear to be inconsistent. It's more important to some people to keep from appearing inconsistent than it is to be right once they found out that they're wrong, that they were wrong. Right? Okay, well, I know we introduced an awful lot of stuff there, and let's go ahead and have some comments, and then we'll get back to this stuff here. Brother Ben? Mm-hmm. And don't think for a minute that the only people that are subjected to peer pressure are teenagers. Everybody, I don't care how old we are, everybody has peer pressure. Everybody. Okay, Hank? It's good if you can see a picture if you're trying to put a puzzle together, is what Hank is talking about. I mean, you go to some people with your puzzle box and you say, boy, I need some help with this. The best help they can give you is to show you a picture. Okay, all right, I think I can do it now. And then you go and you find the picture and you follow through with it. Yes, sir? Exactly. All right, now, that comes right back to our point here. If we're trying to provoke questions and get the young person to think, we're going to be leading and teaching them in a different way than we will if we say, here's your list, behave according to this list. If you're really teaching that young person, aren't they going to be questioning? If somebody comes to you and says, why do we do this? Don't always treat that as though that were an indication of a heart that's filled with rebellion. They may be doing the very thing that you want them to do, which is to think and have a reason. Now, let me use an illustration. I talked to Jim Berg about this a lot, and I asked him from time to time, Jim, why does the university do so-and-so? Why do they require so-and-so? I have never asked him a question about a rule that BJ has when he couldn't give me what I consider to be a reasonable answer. And I thought, well, you know, if I was there, I'd probably do that too. Now, it's real easy for us to sit back and be a Monday morning quarterback. I mean, you know, sometimes I think, well, you know, if I was running that place, I'd run it a little different. But they don't call me every day to ask me what to do, you know? They just kind of figure out what they want to do over there and do it themselves. So, fine. If they don't want my advice, now, that's the way sometimes we think. But whenever I start having a question, I think, you know, now why do they do that? And I say, Jim, you gotta help me here. Why do you all do this? And he says, well, boom, boom, boom. And I said, oh, yeah, it makes sense. I'd probably do that too. Now, I appreciate that. But you know what? When you assume that people make rules for no good reason, you're hesitant even to ask them. Because you think, well, they don't have any good reason for making these rules. They're just in charge. They're going to keep me under their thumb. And therefore, you know, I just have to submit. And there becomes an adversarial role and a reluctance and all this kind of thing. And the same thing is true in the minds of a lot of people in their relationship toward the Lord. All right, now, I want to hear from a couple of the ladies. I saw a lady's hand over here. All right, here's one. And then, Ms. Cook, you had a comment a while back, if you can remember. Okay, yes. Right, that's right. We're talking about two different things here. We need to understand that. What Ms. Cook is talking about is a family that she worked with where they had a real rigid view on something, and then when they got older, they found they couldn't enforce that, and then their attitude changed. Now, there is a sense in which when we get older and our children get older, they help us understand that our rigid standards have really been unreasonable. And we need to grow and be willing to change in order to be right. There is another sense in which as our children get older and we get older, it becomes extremely expensive in emotional energy and time for us to maintain the standards that we established. And what we do is compromise and say, I can't make this work and it's not worth it, so forget it. That is devastating. That is a good way to destroy faith in our children. So in the one hand, there is a sense in which we change when we shouldn't. There is another sense in which we should change, and sometimes we don't. So we have to be having the discernment to see in what areas we grow and be willing to change as our children grow, and then in other areas in which things we hold the line and have the reasons and explain those reasons and take our stand, you see. But again, thinking is the whole thing. And I've said to you before, and I say again, don't leave your brains at home when you come to church. And don't try to teach your children to follow you blindly. You want them to question. You want them to think this through. You know where most of us are going to end up if we really become honest and stay honest and rationally think through? You know where most of us are going to be as far as our standards are concerned? We're going to be where good, honest people have been all along. When we first get saved, we look at people that we trust and we say, they're doing it this way. That must be the way to do it. And then we go through a period of questioning and we say, is this really necessary? Do you really have to do all those things? And we kind of kick at the traces a little bit. And we reevaluate and we think it through. And if we stay honest, eventually we'll come right back to it and we'll say, I see now why they did it. But once you've thought it through and you've come to that conviction because it is your conviction, it'll mean a lot different to you. It'll be a lot different to you than it would if you just adopted it because you were trying to identify with the group in those early days. That make sense? The problem comes in with people who adopt the standards because they want to identify with the group, and they never make those standards theirs because they are God's. They are the standards of the peer group, and the person adopts them not because they want to honor God, but because they want to identify with the peer group. You follow that? And that's true in fundamentalism just like it is any other society which has clear-cut standards or rules. Okay, Ms. Smith? Right. Okay, remember the other laws when those kinds of experiences come up. That when you're working with very little children, you have, at first, you have a responsibility to teach them to memorize the answers and to quote them back to you, but at the same time, question them as they grow older. They have to memorize it first. That's the way the learning process begins. That forced attention, if you will. That active attention. You force them to pay attention. You force them to give the answer. But you don't just stop there. Your teaching and their learning is not finished when they can quote an answer to you that they don't necessarily understand. You have to continue to teach and continue to learn and continue to go on until they finally understand it. And then they can become a teacher of others. Now that's exactly the same thing that's true in winning a soul. When you lead a soul to Christ, you haven't finished your discipleship just because they can spit out the right answer. They have to be able to understand that and apply it to life. You know, one of the things that we do in our aggressive churches where we go after people and we win souls and we bring them in and then we give them the attitude that we have of saying, okay, you sit down now and you listen to me and I'll tell you how to live, and if you live that way, you'll be successful. Friend, you can't think of all the circumstances of life that they're going to go through. The only way they're going to survive is if they fully understand these principles and they can take those principles out into their experiences of life and make the application. And that takes a long time. And it takes a lot of commitment from us in the meantime. So while we're teaching them those rote memory answers, we also need to continue to question and lead them. Okay? Yes. Here you're going. All right, so In other words, how far do you go with that kind of a question? All right. Well, I think the answer to that, if your children continue to question your standards, you continue to give the answer until your own questions are settled. Okay? Now, in other words, suppose, for example, that a young person asks you a question that causes you to question your standard yourself. I think you better be honest about that with your young people. I think you better be honest with them and say, well, now here's what, just like Brother Johnson said, we set a standard. We draw a line. This is where we draw the line. Why do we draw it there? I think maybe you need to say, well, you know, I'm not really sure why we draw it there, but I'm not willing to erase it at this point. Let's consider, let's think. And then you continue to talk with them, and you continue to answer it. But if you pull out the big gun too quick and say, because I said so, well then, at that point, what you're teaching them at that point is, don't come to me with your questions. And if you tell them that they can't come to you with their questions, they're going to go to somebody else with their questions. And the people that they will listen to are the ones that treat their questions as though they were legitimate, rather than listening to the ones that have the right answers. Yes, sir? Okay, yeah. All right, you say, look, we got to hold the line someplace. Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with having that principle. That may be the reason that you're doing it. I think you need to understand that. Okay? Yes, sir? Good point. That's good. That's right. You know, this is not related to what we're talking about, but let me just further that a little bit. You know, sometimes if you let the kids set the standards, they'll be a lot more strict on themselves than you would. You know? If you let them answer their questions, they'll be a whole lot more rigid on themselves. Why? Because every young person wants... We're not going to get any further than this. Let's just... Okay? Time's gone. Most of what we've been talking about today has nothing to do with what we got up there anyway. Okay? But it's okay. The reason that young people question the rules is not because they don't want to obey them, but because they do want rules, but they want rules they can trust. That is the case. Now, I believe that. Do you believe that? I think most people want dependable boundaries, safe fences. They want things which will protect them, and when they question those and they weaken, then they feel insecure. Young people want to know that there are rules and standards and guidelines that are going to keep them safe. And they're going to go up every now and then, and they're going to check the locks. Anybody going to get in here and get me? You see? And let me tell you something. If they lose confidence in the rules, or confidence in the rule maker, they're going to be very insecure. And they're going to come to believe that they would be better off out on their own making their own rules, which they wouldn't. Okay? But that's the way that happens sometimes. So we need to be willing to explain to our children and to explain to new Christians why we do some of the things we do. Now, one of the biggest problems that you're going to have in trying to win the community, trying to win people within the community, is that they have heard about, quote, the rules, and they don't understand why we have the rules, and they want to argue with you about those rules. And I believe, frankly, and I mean this, that one of the reasons, if not one of the main reasons, that Christian people are reluctant to be soul winners today is because they have become weary in defending the rules because, hear me, they don't understand them themselves. They don't know why we have these rules. I don't know why we can't dance. I don't want to dance anyway. What difference does that make? And you go out and you win somebody and maybe he loves to dance. Well, you know, you all don't believe in dancing, right? Well, no. Well, why not? Oh, no. Well, it's wrong. Well, he danced in the Bible. Well, you know, what are you going to do when people start asking you questions like that? And you got a rule here and you don't even understand why you got that rule? I'm not advocating dancing, by the way. Anytime you want to discuss it, I believe I can give you a good argument as to why we don't do it. Okay? Can you? You see what I'm saying? And after a while, you get tired of going through that kind of stuff. Well, I don't know why we got these rules. Look, hear me. Teach and go to preaching here. The reason that most Christian people adopt the standards is because they want to identify with the group and not because they understand the biblical reason behind those standards. And then we go to our kids and we say, I just don't give in to that peer pressure. And they look back and think, Dad, what are you doing? How come you do half the stuff you do? Don't question me. I'm your father. Is that who you are? He's thinking. I always wondered why you came in every night. You know, I mean, and they can get real sarcastic in a hurry. You see? Isn't that right? And we sit here and we put this whole discussion on this intelligent level. You know? And meanwhile, the kid's thinking, not going to get any help here. You know? Better go talk to this heathen teacher over here somewhere. Isn't that right? Yes. Defend. That's right. Defend it. Listen, don't ever be afraid to give your children an opportunity to think. Listen, the reason I believe in fundamental Christianity, the reason I am a Bible believer, is because after examining and thinking through and considering the reasonableness of it, the faith that the Lord gave me in my heart added to that reasonableness, I have come to the conclusion in my heart, by faith, that this is the truth. This makes sense. It will bear examination. It really will. The reason I don't believe in evolution is because evolution is completely illogical. The Bible has the answer. That makes sense to me. Now, I don't just believe the Bible because it makes sense. I believe the Bible by faith. And the reason the evolutionist believes that is because he accepts it by faith. Isn't that right? You have to start with some basic presupposition, and then you reason from there. You grant me that the Bible is what it claims to be. You give me that. And then we'll follow every rule of debate thereafter. And you'll end up being a Bible believer. You grant me that the world is 50 million years old, and that there was a big bang someplace, which is a great, tremendous blind leap of faith, and you won't get 5 minutes till you find an inconsistency. And if you're going to be honest, you've got to deal with those inconsistencies. You start somewhere and you start reasoning. Now, my contention is if you start with the fact that the Bible is true, by faith, accept that by faith, the Bible is what it claims to be, you won't find a flaw in an honest fundamentalist's reasoning. Not a one after that. And you'll end up where our churches are. I believe that with all my heart. And if I didn't, I wouldn't be here. I want to be where the truth is, don't you? Don't you want that for your kids? The law of the teaching process basically says, don't make blind disciples that can't think for themselves. Teach your kids to think and to reason and to be... Listen, what we believe can bear the scrutiny of questions. Can't it? Sure it can. It'll last. It'll survive because it's right. So don't be threatened. Don't be challenged. Jordan, you got a comment. We got to quit, but go ahead. Can't skip. Hey, look. Let's quit with this, okay? And really, let's quit, okay? Get up and leave when I get done saying this, okay? All right. If you teach your kids never ever to question anything about what you say, you're teaching them to do one of two things. Either to become a mindless robot on the one hand, or to reject totally what you say on the other hand. Whenever you get a subculture or a church or a movement within fundamentalism or Christianity that says, don't question anything I do. Don't question anything I say. You're going to have two people. You're going to have blindly loyal followers, and you're going to have people that say, forget it. That's what you're going to have. Isn't that right? And the blind loyalty will encourage more of the same. And the people that say, forget it, you can always find a way to say, well, he left because he was, they went out because they were not of us and all this kind of thing. You can always find a way to justify it. Listen. If it don't make sense, question it. Because what you take out of here with you is your own mind, not somebody else's mind. And you've got to be able to understand why you believe what you believe. That's the law of the teaching process. Okay, Al, make your comment and then pray. The Lord answered every honest question, didn't he? You study that. Okay, Al, dismiss us.